For KOSU News, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. The Board of Equalization meets with Governor Stitt as its chairman for the first time. The board certified more than $8.2 billion for appropriations in the next fiscal year, which begins June 30th. While it was nearly $38 million less than December, it's still almost $575 million more than last year. Neva, this has got to be good news for lawmakers and Governor Stitt.
It is good news, but when you think about the fact that state agencies have already given increased requests, over $1 billion, $33 million in requests for additional supplemental appropriations. I mean, there's a lot to fight over still. And I think what did happen is that the governor has made it very clear what he sees as the priorities he would like for those dollars. And when he talks about $200 million for the rainy day fund, taking it out, and then you hear the House AMB chair, Kevin Wallace, talk about that perhaps 10%, more like $50 million, might be a number that he would throw out there as something to go into the rainy day fund. You can see that there's lots of give and take still to the overall equation, and what that's really going to look like at the end. I think what we're seeing is just this beginning of a rollout of the discussion back and forth, and all of the parties being able to kind of put their two cents in.
Yeah, but Ryan, this is basically when the budget talks start.
Well, they start, and you know, they typically don't end until, you know, the last week of the legislative session in May. So, I mean, this is kind of our base number, and I think Neva's right. Good news up front, but there's still some concern. I mean, what we are looking at here is, instead of a shortfall, which is what legislative leaders have been looking at for years in the past, we have an actual surplus this year of funds to come in. And a lot of that has to do with revenue packages that were passed last year that put more money into the general revenue fund. You know, Governor Stitt's right to say that a lot of this is already obligated. You know, so, you know, we shouldn't look at this $500+ million and think that, well, we've got $500+ million to expend. A lot of that is already earmarked. It's already appropriated. That part of the budget process is done. But when we look at, you know, the agency requests that Neva mentioned, those agency requests aren't to put you know, icing on top of the cake. They're trying to build the cake back. I mean, we have cut agencies so much. And we talked last week about the shortage, the teacher shortfall, the crisis that we're facing here in Oklahoma. I think we should start looking a little deeper than that to support staff, cafeteria workers, janitorial staff. I'm the grandson of a cafeteria worker. You know, they have the idea that when we look at what's going to be left over of this, the idea that we're going to be able to put more money into the classrooms, more money into teacher salaries, more money into support salaries, or other public employees, that looks to be in jeopardy right now. And I think it's incredibly important to remember that where we're at right now, even though the budget looks better, it's still 10% below where we were 10 years ago when we adjust for inflation.
You know, and I think it's interesting that 200 plus, 237 million that's already obligated, when you take that out, if you talk about the fact that the Speaker of the House and the Governor have kind of doubled down on this $1,200 additional pay raise for teachers. Senate seems to be a little less enthusiastically coming on quite as strongly. When you look at those, I mean, the number, the dollar figure then left is under $100 million that everyone is fighting, you know, fighting to see where those dollars go. And you already have cabinet members who are saying we need some additional things on the table, such as this basically quick fund so that they can go out and as they're trying to recruit and bring industry and businesses in, that they've got access to funds, other you know, some other innovative digital technology funds and other things that they're talking about to incentivize agencies to get more aggressive in that area. So it really is going to be, I think this the honeymoon is going to be quickly over, and now we're going to be into the weeds of how do we go back and forth. And when you have the House Democratic leadership basically saying, look, our caucus wants all the money spent, we don't want any in the savings account, I think that that clearly is going to be a very partisan divide that's going to cause some angst back and forth as these discussions go forward.
And it's difficult to forecast a lot of this stuff, but when we look, but we're being told right now by the folks that are looking at markets, not just in Oklahoma, but globally, mm-hmm. that we should anticipate that the revenue that we're seeing right now might not increase for the 2020 fiscal year. So, you know, we may continue to see some small increases, But we could very well end up in a situation where budget growth or revenue growth is flat or begins to taper off because of, you know, falling oil and gas prices or any number of areas where we depend heavily upon for to get our revenue.
And I think when you have a governor who is being very emphatic about what he wants to see himself in terms of how this money's being spent, I think that $200 million that he wants to see go into the rainy day fund, I mean, he's not going to let that just zero out and say, okay, we're not going to do that at all. There's going to be a give and take, and he clearly is going to be a very aggressive part of the process in this budget process, he and his team and his cabinet, in you know, helping to shape this. So it won't be, I don't think it will be a passive proposition at all. I think they will see, at least at this point, it appears the governor very engaged in this process from day one.
And he probably won't keep all $200 million of that. I think that he'll get some of it up. I mean, some of it may go to classroom
spending.
Start high
so you can negotiate. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, we look at things like the Department of Corrections, they're in a real bind as well. I mean, state agencies, like I've said, you know, they're still suffering from years and years and years of cuts. And so trying to absorb those while we're banking $200 million away, that's going to give a lot of folks heartburn.
A Senate panel passes a measure to expand health care to low-income Oklahomans. Rather than expanding Medicaid through Affordable Care Act, Senate Bill 605 asks the Trump administration for a waiver to expand Insure Oklahoma to use federal funds to expand health care through private insurers. Ryan, how does Senator Greg McCourty's bill compare with expanding Medicaid?
Well, so if we look at what this would, I mean, it would essentially, instead of having a public option that folks would be able to participate in that would be ostensibly run to the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority, people would just automatically be able to be enrolled in Medicaid, what we've seen in Medicaid expansions in other states. This would allow people to, through their employers or through, if they're self-insured or temporarily unemployed, be able to have subsidized coverage through the private marketplace. This is not what I would say would be a perfect plan. We've seen it unroll in places like Arkansas and I believe Indiana to some success. They've dramatically reduced the number of uninsured in those states. I don't think that it's a substitute for creating a more public option where you've got folks being able to participate in Medicaid in the state of Oklahoma. One of the other concerns that I think that is on a parallel track with this is that there are a number of bills in the legislature that would, under some rules that have been implemented by the Trump administration, that would allow states to begin to water down what private policies have to cover in terms of pre-existing conditions. They might be able to raise rates on individuals based on geography, based on age, based on gender. You know, so there are some the rights that were afforded under the Affordable Care Act, you know, could be watered down under these private policies. So if we turn it entirely over to the private marketplace, we may not end up in a situation where people are getting the same kind of insurance they would get under pure Medicaid expansion. But that said, this is a big step forward in having this conversation about bringing federal dollars in to invest in healthcare in Oklahoma.
Neva.
I think that's right. I think when you have a situation where it's not a non-starter, but there is a discussion point to launch from, I think it at least gives rise to the expectation that maybe something can move in this direction. And it's a long way from happening, clearly. Some would suggest that this is kind of the beginning point, and it may well not happen this session in any fashion, but may move into next session. But at least the conversation moves forward. The governor has said, interestingly, I mean, he said that he might be open, as we've talked about, to expansion, but he's also made it very clear that he's not going to do that if he's not given authority to make his selection for the healthcare authority director. So I think, again, it's this give and take of having some leverage in the conversation of where it moves forward. And I think when you look at Medicaid expansion, the fact that there has been no real appetite among Republican lawmakers and the former governor during Mary Fallon's tenure to really have this discussion at all, I think that the fact that Senator McCourtney and others have worked very hard to get this to a place where there are some specifics and some real objective ideas to look at, and look at it with the backdrop of where has it worked and where has it not worked well in other states? Not just kind of take an Arkansas model or an Indiana model or any other model, but look at other states where they're being even more, more creative. I think in the instance of, I believe it's North Carolina, where they're really kind of reshaping the whole notion of this, the Medicaid dollars and what they can do with it and trying to be much more innovative than we've seen in the past. Hopefully Oklahoma in this discussion will take that approach.
One of the things that interested me when I was listening to Senator McCourtney talk about this bill was that it would take the onus off of the state and put it onto private companies, which sounds great for the state. Unfortunately, then you get the situation where a private company goes, well, then I'm not going to do that. And we've already lost almost all of our insurers when it comes to the Affordable Care Act.
Or if they do it, they do it in a way that waters down that policy, that it's basically or virtually meaningless unless it's a catastrophic coverage, right? Being able to get your primary care, your routine medical care, preventative care, the things that keep you healthy before you have a catastrophic event, those could be watered down or could be cost prohibitive. Some other thing, one of the biggest arguments that we've heard against this from folks is, well, what if the federal government takes the money away? What if they stop doing the Medicaid match? This has a provision in it that would allow the state 9 months to come back and amend that contract with the federal government if they take that money away. And this may be a starting point for this legislative session where maybe they would think about legislation next year. But what I'm hearing right now is that if the legislature doesn't do something this year, there's an independent group that's prepared to go out and get signatures and put this on a ballot and allow probably
more expanding Medicaid.
Yeah, expanding Medicaid, put a ballot measure in front of the voters that would be a more pure Medicaid expansion measure. So, there is some outside pressure on the legislature to do that. If they want to do this and do it within Insure Oklahoma, model it after either North Carolina, Arkansas. Arkansas, we've had several years. Indiana just did their deal in 2018. So we've got some models there. If the legislature wants to do it through the private sector, this, I think, is their one shot to do it before voters would have an opportunity on more pure Medicaid expansion.
And if the voters do ultimately get this option of making a decision up or down, it's a dicey proposition, because if it goes down, it really sets that conversation back from a legislative standpoint for years, if not decades. So, we've seen this all the way back to, 2006, when Senator Crane got the idea out of committee, and then basically it was DOA when it got tagged as just a full-blown Obamacare. And so the whole notion of where the need is versus where the political, the real political stigma to this is, I think they've got to find a way to navigate through this. And clearly, I would applaud Senator McCourtney for being very very diligent to move it to the point where we're having this conversation today.
If you would have told me that a Republican majority legislature and a Republican legislator from Ada would be carrying anything that resembles Medicaid expansion 2 or 3 years ago, I wouldn't have believed you. This is a real serious conversation, and folks are approaching it like grownups for the most part. And, hopefully whatever comes out the other end of this means that more Oklahomans have health insurance.
A bill allowing anyone over 21 to carry a gun without a permit or training moves a step closer to the governor's desk. After flying through the House last week, it's now heading to the full Senate, what's called constitutional carry, after passing the Senate Appropriations Committee on Wednesday. Neva, what's the hurry here?
Well, I think that clearly most lawmakers have their minds made up on this. I think it is early bills. There's always one or two that kind of get on the fast track and move through. I think in this instance, the governor's made it clear that a bill like this hitting his desk will be signed very quickly. And I think what I would anticipate is early next week, in fact, we'll make it through the process, make it to the governor's desk, and may well indeed be the first bill that Governor Stitt signs in office. So I think the bill itself clearly has worked out a lot of the sticking points that many had concerns with. So I think from a majority perspective, not only Republicans in the House and Senate, the Republican governor, but the public at large seems to be strongly behind this particular bill. And I think we will see passage and have it become law.
Right.
First, again, I'm a broken record here, but this is not constitutional carry. It's an incredibly liberal carrying policy that allows people to carry without a license, without requirements on background checks if you're buying from an individual sale. All these things, it opens up a huge door. It's an incredibly liberal gun policy in that regard. It's not constitutional carry. If they think it's constitutional carry, start carrying it in places right now without abiding by those restrictions. Have a police officer cite you, go fight that in court, or go to court and say, I'm afraid of getting cited, mm-hmm. and challenge it in court. And so the Second Amendment clearly says that these regulations and restrictions that Oklahoma currently has violate the Second Amendment. That would be constitutional carry. I think that there are some political optics of why they want this on the governor's desk first. It makes sense that, you know, if he's going to try to, you know, throw some red meat to the base here. I think that if you look at the other legislation that's being fast-tracked right now, it's the Unity Medical Cannabis legislation that would create some regulation there. I think that there's some concern that the first bill that the governor signs is probably a gun bill instead of a marijuana bill. Whether that makes sense or not, you know, that's just an assumption that I'm making. The other thing is that when we start to begin to look at the carve-outs that are being added to this bill, there's a carve-out now being contemplated for the gathering space in Tulsa. There's a carve-out by the NBA. And so why do you think that they're using their considerable lobbying power to say that they need to keep guns out of these spaces? I think it's because they recognize that having unregulated, unrestricted gun possession in these places is dangerous. What I wish would happen would be if the NBA or college campuses or the other folks that are lobbying for carve-outs in this so-called constitutional carry, in this very liberal carrying measure, if instead of lobbying for these carve-outs, if they really believe that it's dangerous to have these guns in their backyard, at their NBA arenas or on their college campuses, then surely that it's dangerous elsewhere, whether it's on the street in front of KOSU radio or in the parking lot of the state capitol. That's where their lobbying needs to be. They need to be talking about where this is dangerous everywhere and trying to kill the bill in its entirety instead of just lobbying for carve-outs.
And this is a permitless carry bill is really what we're talking about. It's a bill that allows a person to be able to carry a firearm without a permit or without training. But these carve-outs allow for the concerns to be addressed rather than it be just either-or proposition to try to intelligently deal with many of the issues that have confronted this bill from day one. And as they have worked through these, I think what we have seen is a real strong effort to try to find something where the majority of all parties can be satisfied with the end result. So I think this is a bill that its time has come. I think the next bill that you mentioned probably will probably in all likelihood may be the second bill on the governor's desk. And I think this process is a healthy process. And frankly, I think it will be interesting to see once we get past these two what happens from here on in terms of the next major bills that hit his desk.
And Ryan, this is not a revolutionary bill. The 15 other states have this, and it's not
That's
increased
right.
the gun violence or anything like that. So it's not, everyone says, oh, you're going to do this and people are just going to be on the streets shooting each other. But other states have passed this bill.
But if you look at numbers, I think if you look at the statistics show that whenever you have more guns in a given area, you're going to have more gun violence. And when I look at Oklahoma right now, we have a lot of untreated, undiagnosed mental illness. We have, and we have a whole lot of guns. And putting more guns in the hands of individuals where they can carry them unrestricted, unlicensed, to me just seems to be a recipe for disaster. So that's my concern. And it is. I mean,
it's a constitutional issue.
We look at the two bills that the governor is going to sign. Probably the first two bills that he's going to sign, a gun bill and a marijuana bill. So weed and guns, welcome to 2019 Oklahoma. This is where we're at.
A bill to crack down on four-day school weeks passes out of the Senate Education Committee. SB 441 passed on to the full House by a vote of 11-6. But schools can stay at four-day weeks if they can prove the schedules aren't negatively impacting student achievement and they save the local district money. Ryan, what do you think of this bill?
You know, I think that it's what they're doing is they're talking about how they're going to measure the mandatory number of school days or curriculum that individual students have to get in order for the school to meet the state minimums. And so what this would do is it would change it from hours to days. And by changing it to days instead of hours, you know, school districts are arguing and education lobbyists are arguing that it takes away a lot of discretion that local school districts need in order to be able to, you know, account for things like weather. You heard that whenever this bill was being debated, That the entire reason that a lot of these school districts went to 4 days was as a political ploy to try to force the issue during the last legislative session to create this huge talking point that went national that said Oklahoma's schools are so underfunded that they had to go to 4 day school weeks. So I don't think that that's the case. I think that these school districts did that because they felt that they needed to. I do think that they're this year we are having a better conversation than we did last year about 4 day school weeks, and that is it actually creating some sort of pedagogical negative impact on students? Is their learning school year affected by going to these four day school weeks? That's an important conversation. I think that the political ploy here is that the Republican caucus at the beginning of the year in the Senate said, we want to go back to 5 day school weeks. We don't like this black eye of the 4 day school week. And you can say that all you want, but really the issue is funding. So if you want to make that your imperative, then you got to back it up with some funding, and in particular classroom funding. And as we talked about earlier with the revenue that we're looking at, that's going to be a difficult proposition for this session.
Neva, the irony of this actually started in 2009 when the Republicans pushed for hours instead of days. I think it was actually Representative Calvi. I remember watching on debate for this on the House floor. So they're kind of trying to erase a mistake they made back in 2009.
Well, and there is this difference of opinion on the issue to this extent. I think the Senate Republican caucus made this one of their kind of five major points that they wanted to advance quickly in this session. But on the House side, you don't see a lot of enthusiasm, even among Republican leadership. You're not hearing the push on the House side. I mean, it's more the local control and the really leaving it there as opposed to making this more overarching reach on it. And I think when you take into consideration, just like with Superintendent Joy Hoffmeister, I mean, she clearly is a strong advocate for the 5 day school week and articulates her points on that, some of which you just mentioned, Ryan, in terms of what is best for the child, I mean, mm-hmm. and the learning experience in the classroom. So I think that infused into whether we have the 4 day week or the 5 day week, that clearly in this particular Senate bill, they have made an allowance to let these school districts, I think there are 92 districts out of the mm-hmm. 500 plus school districts in the state that have gone this direction. So it's a significant number. Whether out of that number, all of them would be able to pass the muster of the criteria set to get them an exemption, I don't know. But the bigger question is, if we're talking about this plus additional classroom funding, then you have to really start to get everybody to the table and figure out what does that really look like? Because right now, the only way you get those dollars is through the funding formula into these districts. Does that get it to the classrooms, and what does that look like? So to advocate for a teacher pay raise and more classroom funding, they've got to figure out how to make all of those dollars work, the numbers work, first of all, but how do you get the expectations and the results that you're really looking for? And I think that's part of this larger conversation that everybody's still really grappling with.
And of course, all these bills are still in their preliminary stage,
yeah.
too.
So. I think Neva raises an interesting point. I just don't know the answer to this, but it'd be interesting to find out. I'm sure someone knows, but if you look at those 92 school districts that are four-day week right now, if you looked at the requirements to get the exemption that's included in this bill, how many of them would currently qualify for that? I just don't know the answer to that.
I don't either, and I haven't seen anything on that, but it would be an important part of the equation, I think, in this conversation.
And they might not have crunched any numbers yet because they weren't sure if they were going to ask for that, but certainly, I know a lot of them did say, we went to this because we were losing money, and this will allow us to recruit teachers, which meant helping our students do better. So it's all going to probably be more likely closer when this gets to the governor's desk.
Yeah.
Leaders in the state Senate say they won't hear a bill to criminalize abortion. Senate Health Committee Chairman Jason Smalley and President Pro Tem Greg Treat have come out against SB 13 reclassifying abortion as murder. The reason was less about their stance against abortion and more about not wanting to deal with a bill which would likely be declared unconstitutional. Neva, what do you think of this decision?
Well, I think I think certainly that Senator Smalley made it clear up front what his intentions were with this bill and why? I mean, that it's not a discussion of, you know, are we, you know, do we support the concept of legalized abortion or not? I mean, or criminalizing it or not, but rather the issue of having this come before that committee and actually a vote being taken. At this point, I think it's still a little bit up in the air what's going to happen just because of the pressure that's being placed on Senator Smalley in particular. I mean, the fact that billboards have been taken out, including one in his district that basically says, here's the guy that's standing in the way of, you know, of being able to basically eliminate abortion in our state, and really sensationalizing this and getting the passion and the intensity up at a high level, engaging, you know, people's pastors and others, and, you know, tossing them into this political powder keg is very difficult. So I think it's a timeline issue. I mean, if it goes through the end of next week, I mean, the reality is that the clock will have run out. They will not be able to hear it. Can they hold this off, or will there be the forceful winds that all of a sudden kind of take it a different direction? I don't know. I mean, I think right now, Senator Smalley, if he stands where he's made his position, if the leadership and Senator Treat and others back that up, then I would think that it's a moot point and it's over. But, you know, we've seen and watched many, many times, about the time we think something's over, then all of a sudden there's a curveball and we're into a whole new ballgame.
Right.
Well, and, you know, it's premature to pat Senator Smalley on the back just yet. We'll see what happens with this pressure that's happening. And it is. It's intense pressure. And he's being asked to do something. And we talk about political stunts. Bills like this, Senator Silk, you know, whether he realizes it or not, he is just a pawn in a very big political stunt here, because this bill, if he passed this bill, it would automatically be declared unconstitutional, and the state would absorb litigation costs, and we would be right back at this again. We've talked a few times on this program about this legislative session, and there seems to be a little bit more decorum between the Republicans and the Democrats. There seems to be a real ideal and an emphasis on cooperating. When you put these bills in front of a legislative committee and you have these fights, you are drawing lines in the sand. And if you're going to draw those lines in the sand, you know, everybody knows where I'm at on this. I support a woman's right to choose and have been to court to protect that, and will go to court again to protect that.
But
if we ask lawmakers to go into these committees and pass these bills, especially when we know that they're going to be immediately declared unconstitutional, you're creating divisions in that legislative body that are just totally unnecessary.
Particularly when you're creating division on an issue where on both sides they agree with where they are on the point. The issue, as you say, is the constitutional question. Yeah. And so that really kind of throws it into a whole different arena, and unfortunately makes the situation long-term much more toxic for the legislative environment.
Especially when you're talking about lawmakers who have pledged and said, I'm going to defend the Constitution.
That's right. And we've got, but there have been two bills that I think that have passed out. Both of them, I think, are of questionable constitutionality. One, I think, is just patently unconstitutional. That's House Bill 1182. That passed out of a House committee, and that would take away a physician's medical license in the event that they perform abortions. I mean, that's just patently unconstitutional. And so, you know, we're seeing, at least in the Senate.
That was in the House side.
In the Senate, I think we're beginning to see some real leadership sitting at the table and saying, listen, we're not going to create this toxic environment just so Senator Silk can go back home and have some mail pieces that says that he's the state's biggest defender of the unborn. Because that's really what this is about. At the end of the day, whatever he wants to do, he's not going to win in the court, and I think Senate leadership understands
that.
And
I think the important thing with Republicans in the legislature overall is the recognition that Oklahoma has been a strong pro-life state with strong pro-life legislation, having moved through and been signed year in and year out for decades, and that has not changed. So to have it sidetracked sometimes with these kind of conversations that really ultimately go nowhere doesn't serve a good purpose in reminding folks really where we are as a state on this issue.
And we're beginning to see some movement on talking about health care for women in rural areas, but when we talk about also sex education, fact-based, evidence-based sex education, we're seeing some traction on that as well.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.